Thanks very much, and thanks for the warm welcome. My name is Paul, and I'm an alcoholic, and it's a privilege and an honor to be asked to come down and speak at your group tonight, albeit on Zoom, and it's one I don't take lightly. And I've been down at your group there a number of years ago. The guys invited me down, and I remember the little church up on top of the hill, and I often joke with Billy, we're driving further and further into the countryside, and I thought to myself, are these guys in the AA Witness Protection Program? Where exactly could this meeting be? We're going further and further into the countryside. And I had a wonderful, warm welcome that time. It was a great day. And we were just joking before the meeting there that Sam drove me to the airport, and my flight was canceled. And Sam, no problem at all, don't even think about an hotel, and brought me right back to his house. And I thought after the talk I gave that day, he would have made me sleep in the barn, but he was kind enough to say, no, well, I brought you up and give me the guest room. And we were talking away and had a wonderful time. And isn't that the wonderful thing of Alcoholics Anonymous? It's the only place I know in the world that you can walk in a room full of strangers and start reminiscing, you know? And I love that fact about Alcoholics Anonymous. I might never drink together, but when you say you're an alcoholic, I know enough. I know you've experienced terror, frustration, bewilderment, and despair. I know that you put a drink to your lips as the tears roll down your face and you drink it anyway. I know that friends and family and loved ones on bended knee sometimes begged you not to drink. I know that, and for goodness sake, at the end of my drinking, I drank against my own will, you know. So it's good to be here with you again. And as you can see there, we're joking with Billy. I'm in my car, you know, and I often tell that joke. Somebody said to me when this Zoom thing first started, they said, Paul, you're sober for a while and you're back living in your car. And I said, yeah, but the good news is it's a better car, you know. So if you're new here tonight, if no other reason to stay sober, when you go homeless, you'll be going homeless in a better car, you know. But actually, I know I don't seem old enough to have a two-year-old daughter. There's nothing wrong with your camera. You don't need to get a cloth out and clean the lens. There's nothing wrong with your camera. I know I don't look old enough to have a two-year-old daughter, but I do, and she's caused mayhem about this time right now. So believe me, this is the easier, softer way to be in the car. So right now, I should have a red cross on the windshield, because this is like Switzerland. It's a neutral zone right now to be with you. And I'm going to tell a little bit of my story, and hopefully weave in about surrender and so forth. But I mean, it even ties into this. Like, when you think about what we're dealing with in the world here, one of our tenets of the first step is unmanageability. And it's like the whole world's having a first-step problem, you know what I mean? Like, their lives have become unmanageable. And thank God for Alcoholics Anonymous. I'm not up on the spiritual hilltop looking down on the unwashed masses, but boy, but do we have a leg up on everybody else, because we realized a long time ago when we came into Alcoholics Anonymous, I mean, not that long ago, that our lives are unmanageable, drunk or sober, if we're running them. And we surrendered in that first step, and it's like the world is catching up to us. They're learning that they're learning unmanageability the way we learned with our drinking and trying to run our lives in Alcoholics Anonymous, you know. And so it's funny. When this first happened, I thought to myself, this is the worst thing that could happen to Alcoholics Anonymous. Oh, my God, this is, hand on head for dramatic effect. This is the worst thing that could have happened to Alcoholics Anonymous, you know. I got to be sitting knee to knee with an alcoholic. My friend Bob says, you can look across and see an alcoholic with skin on, you know. And how is this going to work for the newcomer? But once again, contempt prior to investigation, you're looking at it. And as usual in life, my first reaction is 100% wrong, you know. That's why they say pause when agitated, you know, to give your true self a chance to catch up. Because my ego is right in right away with a completely 100% in the wrong direction. Because not only is this not the worst thing that's ever happened to AA, in the words of Winston Churchill, the British statesman, this is AA's finest hour. The way that Alcoholics Anonymous has stepped up. I'm not saying this is an alternative to organic, you know, regular meetings, but this is what the world has thrown at us. And rather than throw the toys out of the stroller because we don't like the way things are going, His Majesty the Baby, which is what I would normally do, we make it work. We just, I love that about Alcoholics Anonymous. We just keep on figuring out a way to carry this message. My message mightn't even keep me sober, to carry this message to the still suffering alcoholic. You know, as I said there, this is what God's asking us to do right now, and we're doing it in Alcoholics Anonymous with a sense of grace and dignity that I could never have shown with a bottle in my hand. So very, very proud to be a member of Alcoholics Anonymous. And there's some people getting sober now that have never been in an, what we would call a regular meeting, and they're getting sober. God is still working in these rooms of Alcoholics Anonymous, even if it's Zoom rooms, you know. And I want to welcome anybody that's new to AA. I want to welcome you to the greatest singular event in my life. Everything else is secondary and tertiary, coming to the meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous. And I want to say to you, as it says in our literature, let go absolutely. There's a form of surrender. Let go absolutely of all your old ideas and come right into the middle of Alcoholics Anonymous. As I say down in Texas, come all the way in and sit all the way down. And you can do that even in a Zoom room. Get right into the middle of Alcoholics Anonymous. I have a disease that doesn't want me in the middle. I have a disease that tells me I'm different, I'm special, I'm unique. I just say, I thought I seen Al coming on there. Clancy would always say, my disease is different. I have a disease that wants me separated, wants me isolated, wants me detached, wants me removed. I got to ignore all that, even if you're new, and stay right in the middle of Alcoholics Anonymous. You know, in chapter 4 of our book, sorry, I got a wicked cold, guys. In chapter 4 of our book, it talks about the ancient theory of the world being flat. You know, years, centuries ago, people believed that the world was flat. And in some respects, the AA world is a flat earth. If you go to the age of AA, you go off. You know, and so ignore that and stay right in the middle of Alcoholics Anonymous. And when I drift to the edge of Alcoholics Anonymous, it's usually a glacial drift. I don't even realize I'm going till I'm gone. You know, so ignore that. And the thing about getting to the edge of Alcoholics Anonymous, when you get to the edge of AA, if there are any signposts still left, they're in a language you don't speak anymore and a language you don't understand anymore. Because we speak a language in here. It's the language of the heart. And I can't do that without you. When I'm speaking to myself, it's all ego, which is the language of the head. The language of the ego operates from the neck up and all that stuff. When I'm speaking with you and with my brothers and sisters in Alcoholics Anonymous, I'm speaking the language of Alcoholics Anonymous, which is the language of the heart. And I cannot do that language alone. I need you guys in this conversation with me, you know. And on this topic of surrender, it's funny. I know some of the guys know me, but you maybe realize that I'm not from the neighborhood originally. You know what I'm saying? Like, you know, you're from the south, the deep south, you know. I'm from Belfast in Northern Ireland, and I grew up there during the Troubles. You got to love the Irish, you know. We had a low-level civil war going on. I mean, and we euphemistically referred to it as the Troubles. You know, like it's going to end today after tomorrow. I mean, there was terrible bomb shootings and whatnot. And it was along religious lines, you know, Catholics and Protestants. And so one of the big war cries of the Protestant paramilitaries was no surrender. And if you ever go to Belfast now, there's peace, thank goodness. And they'll take you on these tours of all the murals on the walls in Belfast, you know, on both sides of the community. And you'll see in the Protestant community, big murals, no surrender. You'd have seen it on gable walls of houses. You'd have seen it on the sidewalks. You'd have seen it painted on the road, you know. So it's funny we're talking about this surrender around me, but this is a different type of surrender. This is a surrender to Alcoholics Anonymous. And it took a lot to bring me. My goodness, you know, it was a photo finish. I got here one step ahead of the Undertaker, and it was a photo finish. You know, the surrender, it's almost like, I mean, this disease of alcoholism, it's a disease that tells me that you're the problem. It's a disease that, you know, but the key to success in Alcoholics Anonymous is total surrender. I had to let go absolutely of all my old ideas. And one of my old ideas was that somewhere, someday, under the right circumstances, I could have half a dozen drinks and get away with it. That idea had to be smashed. And booze smashed it. Booze was the best 12-stepper of all. As it says in the literature, alcohol beat me into a sense of reasonableness. If another man had done to me, I always loved that joke, you know, if another man had done to me what drink did to me, I'd have killed him with my bare hands. You know, what's the old joke? Only ever had one bar fight, and that was a draw. Although most people watching say that she won, you know, but what I'm saying is if another man had done to me what I allowed drink to do to me. Now, I didn't start off thinking I was going to be an alcoholic. None of us do. But I look back on it now, and I'm sober long enough. It isn't life like that. It's lived forward but understood backwards. And I can see where alcohol, right from the very beginning. I've heard people tell different stories, you know, that come into some success in their lives and then they cross that invisible line. That is not my story. I started drinking at 15 years of age. And within, and you know, we often wonder, like, you know, I used to get a lot of mental gymnastics when I first came to AA. Why did I become an alcoholic? When did I become an alcoholic? Where did I become an alcoholic? You know, the old alcoholic joke, what came first, the chicken or the keg, you know? There's a lot of guys that got drunk. Today, I just accept the fact that I'm an alcoholic. And I like what it says in the doctor's opinion. I'll go with that. I drink because I like the effect produced by alcohol. I liked it. I like the produced effect, the effect produced by alcohol. That's why I drank. I took that drink at 14 or 15 years of age, and the perpetual stone that was in my shoe was suddenly removed. The knot that was always seen to be in my stomach was gone. For the first time in my life, my skin seemed to fit my body. I could be everything I thought you wanted me to be, and for a chronic people pleaser with low self-esteem, it was a magic elixir. But I look back on it now, and it was a Faustian bargain. I made a deal with the devil. Booze will give you a lift, but when it came time to pay the freight, oh my goodness. In The Merchant of Venice, Shylock just wanted £1 of flesh, not this disease. It'll take your job, your car, your wife, the shirt off your back. But what it really wants is me 6 feet under. There's a lot of terminal diseases out there. I'm not familiar with those, but I'm familiar with this one. This disease will kill me stone dead with or without booze in my body. I don't need booze in my body to burn my life to the ground. I almost done it in Alcoholics Anonymous because I wouldn't surrender to the principles of Alcoholics Anonymous. I wouldn't surrender to the fact that there was more wrong with me than drink, and it was going to take more than not drinking to get me well one day at a time in Alcoholics Anonymous. If my problem is just alcohol, I need the first step and I will live happily ever after. But my problem is not alcohol. My problem is alcoholism. And that ISM on the end of that word means that I need everything in that spiritual toolkit that's laid at my feet. And for me, that's a home group. That's a sponsor. That's 12 steps, 12 traditions, unity, service, recovery, all working together. One day at a time, that I can go out there in the real world and on a good day impersonate a normal person on a good day, you know. So that idea, so I took that drinking at 15 years of age and I thought, you know, happy days, you know. And I wanted to be what it says in the next part of the doctor's opinion. I wanted to drink with impunity. And I found out that means without punishment. But I'm an alcoholic. I don't drink without punishment. There's going to be punishment coming. And it's going to come down on my life. And unfortunately, it's going to come down on the people's lives around me. If you were unfortunate enough to hitch your wagon to my star, my falling star, my goodness, you're going to be caused trouble too. Because my alcoholism would be like a rock in a pond. Everybody would get touched by the ripple effect, you know. And that's what I wanted to do. I wanted to drink with impunity, without punishment, but I'm an alcoholic. And the punishment started to come very, very quickly, you know, and I would discount it. I would dismiss it. I would disregard it, the things that were happening to me. You know, Clancy used to say that, and this is, I believe this is to be true. I bartended the last 5 years drinking, and I bartended the first 12 years in Alcoholics Anonymous. And they say in AA, in our book, that most alcoholics, I mean, normal drinkers, they drink because what alcohol does to them. And it talks about it, a social lubricant, you know, companionship, a fire to my imagination. I drink because of what alcohol does for me. Alcohol does something for me that it doesn't do for the normal or even the heavy drinker. One drink changes how I feel about me, you, and this. And that was the story of my life. I wanted to be two drinks smooth. I wanted to be half drunk living in mid-air. But that's not reality. And I pursued that, as our book says, not up to, but into the gates of death and insanity. When I took that first drink at 15 years of age, if someone had tapped me in the shoulder and said, Paul, I want to show you something. Look in that window. You see that guy drinking round the clock against his own will? You see that guy who's pushed away everybody who mattered in his life? You see that guy who has quicksand stretched around him in all directions? That's going to be you in 15 years from now. And I say, you're out of your mind. You must have been thinking of somebody else, but that's exactly what happened. And as I say, I took that first drink, and all the things that were happening to me, I would ignore, disregard, and dismiss because of what alcohol was doing for me. And the punishment would start to come very quickly. I started drinking at 15. Within a matter of months, I was getting my stomach pumped out on a school night. I hadn't even turned 16 years of age. My parents, and things were bad back then in Northern Ireland. I mean, it was bad in my neighborhood. I remember my mother telling me, she goes, you hadn't come home. It was 11 o'clock at night. At that time, things were very, very bad in Northern Ireland. She says, I looked down, there was like the local shops, and she goes, I saw this figure getting up and falling and getting up and falling. She goes, I knew it was you. I hadn't even turned 16. And they rushed me to the hospital, and the doctor told my parents, it's a good job you brought him here. He would probably have died of alcoholic poisoning, you know. And I didn't even tap the brakes. I mean, not there, believe me. And there was other things. This is Alcoholics Anonymous. We all have our stories, you know. We all come from, you know, but pain is the admission price. Every one of us had a handful of coins paying the price of admission of pain when we got to Alcoholics Anonymous, you know. But I would disregard that and discount that and dismiss that because of what alcohol was doing for me. I remember a guy telling me one time, and I didn't like this, he says, Paul, do you want to stop drinking or do you just want the consequences of your drinking to stop? I didn't like that question because that's what I wanted. I wanted to drink with no consequences. I wanted to drink. Sorry, I've got two phones going here and this one just went off for some reason. I wanted to drink without consequences, you know what I'm saying? But there's not. And that's what I wanted to do. I wanted to drink without consequences. And here's the sad thing about the surrender to the first step of Alcoholics Anonymous. This is a tricky disease. It's so cunning, so baffling, so powerful. Like I said earlier on, it tells me, it convinces me that everybody else is the problem. I remember close up to the end of my drinking, and I would wake up in the morning, and I worked in a crazy bar here in Rockaway Beach, and I used to bartend. I mean, it was pretty sad. I was the worst bartender in the worst bar in Rockaway Beach, and that was against some pretty stiff competition, you know what I'm saying? Like, you know, the bar I worked in, it was like happy hour on the island of Dr. Moreau. I mean, there was a lot of crazy things went on in that bar, you know. And I would, 4 o'clock in the morning, I would ring out the register, maybe have a couple of drinks with the guy that was cleaning the place up, take some booze home with me. To cut a long story short, I would wake up around lunchtime or 1 o'clock in the afternoon, and my hands would be shaking so bad, you know, and I'd reach for the bottle off the bedside table or off the floor, and I'd take a drink out of that bottle. And almost like in a, you know, the science fiction movie, I could almost see the booze coursing my veins, almost like in a science fiction movie, and my hands would stop shaking, and I would say to myself, thank God for alcohol. If it wasn't for booze, I don't know what I would do. Up until very close to the end, I thought alcohol was holding me together, when in actual fact, it was the thing that was tearing me apart, you know? And I've experienced every form of drinking. I was a weekend drinker, a daily drinker, a morning drinker, binge drinking. But the drinking that put my lights out, I became a periodic alcoholic. And you know the equation, the drunks would get longer and the period between them would get shorter. And I drank, and as I said, it was almost a photo finish. I got here one step ahead of the Undertaker, you know. And with the grace of God and Alcoholics Anonymous, two guys from the Old South Bronx group, that a group here in New York City called the Old South Bronx group. And that group had a mantra: we don't give up on anybody. And they came to my apartment. Now, I didn't go to Skid Row, but I brought Skid Row to me. I mean, I've been on this drunk for about 10 or 11 days, and barroom drinking was a memory. I was like, I'd become like a shut-in. Whenever I drank, I would love nothing more than close the blinds, and just like that line from The Godfather, I would go to the mattresses and just go at it round every waking moment, pass out, wake up. And a note came under my door. And the note said what I've been hearing since I was a kid back in Northern Ireland at 15. Paul, you're a nice guy, but you drink too much. And I had a man's telephone number on it. And I called, I was in so much pain. And this is, talk about surrender. This was a form of surrender. The fact that I picked up that phone, I'm Irish, stoic, don't tell nobody nothing. Keep your voice down, the neighbors might hear. All that old thinking. And I picked up a phone. This is so alien to my personality. I picked up the phone and called a complete stranger. But I was in so much pain, I thought to myself, there's got to be another way. And I called this guy, and he'd been primed that I might call. And he says, Paul, there's me and another guy who's going to come over to your apartment. What's the address? And I told them where I live. And these two guys came to my apartment. Now, I thought they were going to talk about my drinking. Because August of 1992, the few people that were left in my life, that's all they wanted to talk about. Paul, we need to talk about your drinking. Paul, sit down here a second. We have to talk about you. And the ironic thing was, they didn't talk about my drinking. They sat down and they told story after story of their own drinking. And then the magic happened. Our most prized possession, identification. They talked about them, and I found out about me. And I remember putting my head in my hands, almost like that classic picture of the man in the bed. And I said to the guy, I cannot live one more day like this. And I look back on it. That was taking the first step. I cannot live one more day like this. And he says, Paul, this is your lucky day, because you don't have to live that way anymore. And about 36 hours later, I was well enough to get put in a car and get bookended in and get brought to my first meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous. Now, this guy told me something many years later, and he'd been in Alcoholics Anonymous, this guy Jerry Seaman, a wonderful guy. He'd been in Alcoholics Anonymous since 1961, was a personal friend. I mean, a lot of people in New York that got sober in the late 50s to the early 60s, oh, I knew Bill Wilson. They maybe saw him at a meeting, or he signed their big book at the Bill Wilson dinner dance. But this guy, Jerry, actually knew Bill Wilson. Bill Wilson asked him for his story for the third edition, and he didn't want to do it. He knew Bill Wilson very, very well. And he would say something to me, and I didn't realize at the time. Later on, he says, Paul, you were one of the, he says, you were one of the easiest 12-step calls I ever went on. Because I was done. I was finished. All my scorecards had read zero. I was so beaten by alcohol, beaten into that sense of reasonableness, that I was willing to get in a car with two strangers and go to a room that I'd never been before. And looking back on it, it was the greatest singular event in my life. Walking into a meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous. Unbeknownst to myself, I was moving from the problem to the solution. You know, and I was surrendered that night. I know, I look back on it now, I was surrendered that night when I walked into that meeting. And I can't remember one thing that was said at that meeting. I don't know who spoke, what they said, what they didn't say. But when I walked out of that meeting, I felt this little feeling in my stomach. I hadn't felt it in a long time. I didn't know what it was. But tonight I know what it was. It was hope. That's what Alcoholics Anonymous is. Oh, sorry, guys. That's what Alcoholics Anonymous is. It's hope in human form. People get people sober. And that's what that feeling was when I walked into that first meeting, or walked out of it, actually. I had this little kernel, this little feeling of hope. And I'm so glad they didn't ask me that night to, here, hand me a clipboard with a lot of options on it. Hey, check the box for what you want. I would have checked the box for not drinking. I would have been delighted with that. But once again, I was shortchanged myself. Because I got that in the first half of the first step. But I got so much more after that. I got the other steps that helped me do what I couldn't do, drunk or sober. And that's live out there in God's world under his conditions rather than my demands. My sponsor says that the wonderful thing about Alcoholics Anonymous, that the program, it's so front-loaded on the solution. You surrender in the first step, and then they move you right into the solution. If I had anything to do with the steps, and it's a good job I didn't, I would have 11 steps about drinking and maybe one step on the solution, but thank God the first 100 men and women were a lot more on the ball spiritually than I am. Because one step states the problem, and then right away, we surrender in that first step, and we get right into the solution of Alcoholics Anonymous. So I'm sitting here tonight, not an arm's length away from a drink, but 12 steps away from a drink because of the program of Alcoholics Anonymous. You know, it's an incredible program. And I'm glad that first meeting, fictitious guy with the clipboard, because some of the things that Alcoholics Anonymous has given me, in fact, the greatest things that AA has given me, when I walked into that meeting in August of 1992, I didn't know that they existed. I didn't know they existed. The greatest things, you know. And to be sitting here sober tonight, haven't had to take a drink since I came to Alcoholics Anonymous. When I think about, I look back when I took that first drink, you might as well have tied a kamikaze scarf around my forehead. I mean, my life was a complete disaster after I took that first drink at 14 or 15 years of age. But the part I would like to talk about here is the whole program is a stage of surrender. And here's the difference. Oh my God. Here's the difference between, I think I said myself as an alcoholic, and they talk about the ego of the alcoholic. I tried to stop drinking before I came to Alcoholics Anonymous. But I wanted to stop on my terms. See, the ego wants to, it's like when the surrender, you know, like when at the end of a war, there's a surrender and they sign the terms of the peace agreement. My alcoholic ego always wanted to be involved in the terms of the surrender agreement. I'll do this, but I won't do that. I'll do this, but just this much. When I was totally surrendered, when I came to AA in August of 1992, and I was totally surrendered. See, the ego is about giving up. Total surrender is about letting go. And I found the hard way, and in Alcoholics Anonymous, that there's a big difference between giving up and letting go. Giving up, I still want my peace. I still want to have the last word. I want to have the symbolic victory. I want to be involved. I want to have my fingerprints all over the surrender agreement. When I let go absolutely, my fingerprints are gone. And hopefully only God's fingerprints. prince around the situation. I'm letting go absolutely. Whatever it is, God, I'm willing to do. I'm not in there tweaking it, trying to see what I can squeeze out of it. And I found it the hard way. Believe me, the hard way in Alcoholics Anonymous, the difference between giving up and letting go. Because I would like to tell you that when I came to that first meeting, in August of 1992, that I grabbed the ball, I know it's a Sunday, and ran the full length of the field and scored a touchdown. But I didn't. Because I came into Alcoholics Anonymous with old ideas. Barroom mentality. Ideas that might serve me well at 2 o'clock in the morning in some gin mill under the L here in New York City, but weren't helping me at all in Alcoholics Anonymous. And our book's talking about it. Let go absolutely of all your old ideas. And I carried them in, barroom mentality. I carried it into AA. And I was surrendered. But it's a stage of surrender. I surrendered to the fact that I couldn't drink. I understood that. But there was a second surrender came for me. And that was surrendering to the program of Alcoholics Anonymous. I've been the jumping off place twice in my life. Once with drink and once with no drink and no program. It's a different type of pain, but it's pain nonetheless. I often talk about the three parts of the triangle. Unity, service, and recovery. Anybody that's new with a symbol in AA, a triangle inside a circle, there's three parts to it. Unity, service, and recovery. I believe from your very first meeting, you can put all three parts of the triangle into your life. The unity, we do together what I cannot do alone. Service, service keeps me once again connected, tethered to Alcoholics Anonymous. So if you're new, drop an anchor, NAA, a service anchor, NAA, so you stay tethered and connected to Alcoholics Anonymous. And then recovery. Maybe the 12 steps seem like, oh my goodness, what's this? We have slogans, easy does it, live and let live. They were like the banisters to the steps. As I put my foot up on step one, those slogans kept me steady. Now I'm here to tell you, I come into AA. That's it. I'm totally realized that booze had beat me in the sense of reasonableness, totally surrendered. But I wasn't surrendered to the fact that there was more wrong with me than drink. And it was going to take more than not drinking to get me well in Alcoholics Anonymous. As I said earlier on, if my problem's just drink, I need the first step and I'll live happily ever after. Nice to see you guys. Thank you so much for the information. I'll see you on the sunny side of the street and I'm off. And there's people that do that. They're called normal or even heavy drinkers. Our book talks about them. A medical reason, a romantic reason, and they can stop or even moderate. But then it talks about us, the real alcoholic. I have alcoholism. I mean, I'll give you one vignette that just sums this up. Maybe you've heard me tell this story before. I'm on a bad drunk one time, and I ran out of booze in the middle of the night. But I was a bartender in Rockaway. I always knew where to get my hands on drink. And I go down to a bar, and the bars here in New York City, they close between 4 a.m. and 8 a.m. They're open 20 hours except for those 4 hours. And the guy was in cleaning the place up, the porter. And I knocked on the side door and he looked out, seen who it was, knew me, let me in, knew what I was looking for. I wasn't there to say, hey, what about those gents, you know? He knew why I was there. And he put a bottle of whiskey up on the counter, a bucket of ice and a bottle of beer and went on cleaning the place up. And I'm having a few drinks, sir. And I collapsed on the floor in an alcoholic seizure. And I woke up in the local hospital where I had been before. And there was a woman standing by the bedside that was close to me at that time in my life. And I took her hand. And I wasn't trying to be cinematic. But I took her hand and I said, listen, it's obvious I can't drink. I know I can't drink. My record has proved it. That's it. I'm done. It's over. If you got a contract, I would have signed it with my own blood. I know Al's on here. Our dear friend Bob would say, put me on a polygraph. I would pass with flying colors because I meant it. not at a visceral level. I'm done. It's over. But I left that hospital. This is a true story. I left that hospital thinking I'm done. But I really didn't know what the problem was, step one. That I got a body won't let me drink and a mind won't let me stop. That one drink creates a thirst I can't quench. That when I control my drink and I don't enjoy it, and when I enjoy my drink and I can't control it. That one drink tonight, destination unknown. I didn't really fully know that. I sure didn't know what the solution was, step 12, a spiritual awakening as a result of these steps, past tense. And I certainly didn't have anybody in my life, these beautiful people, to bring me between the two. I left that hospital vowing that I wasn't going to drink again. But I'll tell you, tonight, up until this moment in time, I have never beaten an obsession to drink in single-handed combat, if you're new. But here's what happens to me when I try to stop drinking without 12 steps, 12 traditions, unity, service, recovery. A week went by, and I got a week. The stone comes back in the shoe. 2 weeks go by, now I've got a knot in the stomach. 3 weeks go by, I got 3 weeks. The top button of my shirt feels tight all the time. A month goes by. You could fry eggs in the back of my neck. I'm ready to explode. Now, you put me in any machine in the world. Any machine in the world. After 30 days, you will not find a trace of alcohol in my body. I submit to you, that's not a drinking problem. That's a living sober problem. And I drank again. And our book says the alcoholic is the bewildered one. Nobody was any more confused than me. I couldn't believe that I drank after that hospitalization. I was shocked that I walked into a bar and ordered a drink again. You see, because before I came to AA, I had nothing between me and the first drink. And that's what tells me tonight that I don't have a drinking problem. I have alcoholism. And I didn't buy into that when I got to AA. I thought that old plug in the jug and you just sit there and you white knuckle it, you know. I often tell this story, and I'm in so much pain in Alcoholics Anonymous, sitting there in pain. There's a club here across the street, the Yacht Club, and I think they're coming in after a few drinks. But I often tell the story of I'm sitting in Alcoholics Anonymous in the rooms of AA, sober, but I'm in so much pain. Because I won't get into the steps of Alcoholics Anonymous. I won't surrender to the rest of the program. It was the old legend of St. Patrick when he was bringing Christianity to Ireland. He wanted to get one of the... That was Ireland's problem. We had four kings. And he figured if he got one of the kings to become a Christian, then all his subjects would become a Christian. So he convinced one of the kings to let go of the old pagan druid ways and become a and be baptized. So he's baptizing the king, and he gets to the high point of the ceremony, and you ever seen the photograph, the pictures of St. Patrick, called a crozier. It's like a long steel staff with a circle on top and the cross in the middle. And at the high point of the ceremony, he drove the staff into the ground, and he didn't realize it. He inadvertently drove it into the king's foot, and the king winced, but said nothing. At the end of the ceremony, St. Patrick looked down and he seen the blood coming through the king's sandal. And he said, what happened? And the king said, well, you know, we never... And St. Patrick said, why didn't you say something? And the king said, I thought the pain was part of the ceremony. I thought the same way in Alcoholics Anonymous. I'm from that old school. If it ain't hurting, it ain't working. And I'm sitting in AA, you know, a one stepper, and I'm the thing about this, I have alcoholism and all this stuff's coming up, and I'm sitting there falling apart from the inside out in Alcoholics Anonymous. I won't tell anybody. I have a sponsor, but in name only. And I ended up with the jumping off place for the second time at 2.5 years sober. I was doing unity. I was going to plenty of meetings. I was doing service. I said, I'm making more coffee than Maxwell House. But I wouldn't do recovery. I wouldn't do door number 3. I'm in AA. I'm not drinking. But my life is completely and utterly unmanageable. I came into AA, I didn't owe very much money. I'm 2.5 years off drink in AA, and I'm thousands upon thousands of dollars in debt. And I know why today. I was still looking for an outside fix for what's really an inside job. I would buy a jacket, I'd feel good for a while, but I always end up back in the same equation, shackled to self. I'd charge a trip to the Caribbean. I mean, all this stuff, insanity. And I had people, there was, I'm not going to be one of these people go, oh, I didn't know. There was people sitting in meetings talking about the problem, talking about the solution, and talking how to go between the two. There was people doing it. But Chuck Chamberlain says, you'll eventually see what you came here to see, and you'll eventually hear what you came here to hear, but you have to have eyes to see and ears to hear. And I was a closed circuit. Nothing was getting in and nothing was getting out. As I said, I had a sponsor, but you can bring a horse to water. You can make him thirsty, but you know how that analogy ends, you know? And my life, I'm here to tell you, you can fool him at the coffee pot at 7:30 at night. I've done it. But you know when untreated alcoholism would come to visit me? 2 o'clock in the morning with the could-haves and the should-haves and the guilt and the shame and remorse, and my past has eaten me alive, and all these people every night visited me, like, you know, all this stuff. And then there's a book that would appear on my bedside table every night at 2 o'clock in the morning, and that book was entitled Where I Should Be in My Life by Now by Paul McQuaid. You start reading that thing at 3 o'clock in the morning, you're ready to put a rope over the rafters. And this is 2.5 years off a drink. A guy came up to me one night at a meeting. Wasn't my sponsor, but God uses you. God works through people. I'm a great believer in that. People get people sober. God works through people. You know, not too many burning bushes and Alcoholics Anonymous. This guy came up to me and he says, Paul, can I talk to you for a second? I said, sure. He says, you're dying. And you're dying right in the middle of AA. Look me right in the eye. You're like a starving man at a spiritual banquet. There's all this food on offer, and you're over there living on bread and water. You've got them all fooled in here with your one-liners and your glib phrases, he says, but I know exactly, because I was exactly where you were, and that's how I know. It was like he walked into my bedroom at 3 o'clock in the morning and pulled the blankets off and threw a bucket of cold water over me. That's exactly what I was doing. But I still wasn't convinced. The ego of the alcoholic, oh my God. The ego. You know, what is the ego? It's the judgment. You know, I'm judging myself, right? You know, she's doing it this way, they're doing it that way. I think what I know what's best. You know, what's the old joke? You know, the alcoholic will prefer death over change. That's so true. What's the old joke? They're lowering the alcoholic into the grave and they're throwing the dirt on top, and then they hear a voice in the coffin. What's that noise? I was right. I mean, it's insanity. It's so insane. Here I am. All this stuff to try to help me, and I'm keeping people there. I'm like the guy from the Heisman Trophy. I got the ball under my arm, and I got the straight arm out, and I'm keeping everybody away from me that want to help me. All they want to do is to help me. And I'm like, no, no, my case is different. You don't understand. And I still wasn't convinced. The next day, it's funny how God works. The next day, this is 2.5 years off a drink, I'm driving out of the Brooklyn Battery Tunnel onto a 6-lane highway called the Gowanus Expressway. And a guy cut me off. And I'm like, oh, really? Rush hour traffic. I drove after him. I jam him against the guardrail. I'm blocking 3 lanes of rush hour traffic. I got out of the car. I didn't care who was in the other car. It could have been Tony Soprano. I'm out of my mind. 2.5 years off a drink with no program. And I go back to the car. Many of you have heard me tell this story. And there was an Asian man sitting behind the wheel shaking. His wife's crying in the passenger seat, and his 3 kids are crying in the back of the car. This is 2.5 years off a drink, no program, because I won't let go absolutely of all my old ideas. I apologized at his car. I got my own car. I hit my head off the steering wheel. And I says, I'm crazier off drink than I was on it. And in some respects, that's true. That second jumping off place, the different type of insanity and pain, but pain nonetheless. And I drove to my sponsor's house, and he was sober a long time, but you can only help somebody that wants to be helped. And he was smoking a big cigar, and I told him what I just told you, and he sat back and he says, how old were you when this happened? I said, how old? It's happened 20 minutes ago. What do you mean, how old? And he coined that phrase of Harry Tebow, the psychiatrist that helped Alcoholics Anonymous, was a great friend of AA, His Majesty the Baby. I'm trying to put a square block in a round hole. I won't grow up in Alcoholics Anonymous. I'm like a child in a man's body. And he said to me, Paul, would I tell you something? I got news for you. They don't make cribs in your size. It's about time you put away all this stuff. You've been tiptoeing around this program. If you don't get into this program, if you don't get into these steps, if you don't get free from the one guy you can't get free from and start to live in the one place you could never live, which is right here, right now, your life's going to go unlived, my friend, and that's on you. He said, this is your miracle. The very least you can do is participate in it. And that's so true. You know, I had to. Well, what am I willing to do to get well? You know, you can get so far in osmosis and Alcoholics Anonymous. Don't get me wrong. I went a long way on other people's recovery. But after, there's a certain point that you got to say, this is my miracle, and I'm willing to do what's required to have it become a reality one day at a time in my life. And it doesn't matter who could be helping you. That guy that I told you about, Jerry, who knew Bill Wilson very well, I'll tell you a story. When he was 6.5 years sober, and I'm only telling these past, nobody would tell this from the podium. When he was 6.5 years sober, he was carrying something around that he had never really fully let go in his fifth step. You know, that one thing that we're going to take to the grave. And he went to Bill Wilson's office, and he knew Bill Wilson well enough to go into his office and talk to him. And he was talking to the co-founder of Alcoholics Anonymous, and he told him, and Bill Wilson said what he would say in those situations. He would talk about the collective experience of AA. He says, Jerry, it's been our experience that those men or women that try to carry the load alone pay a heavy price, perhaps even drink. And Jerry listened to him. This is 6.5 years off a drink. Walked out of his office, and 2 weeks later was drinking again. And the good news is he came back in 67 and stayed sober until he died a couple of years ago. But he would tell that story. You can be sitting talking one-on-one with the co-founder of Alcoholics Anonymous, the guy who pretty much wrote these steps. But if you're not willing to do what's required, even that will not keep you sober. And that was my case. And against my better judgment, bottoming out of 2.5 years, I did that second surrender. And I surrendered to the fact that there's more wrong with me than drink. And we don't do the steps because they're nice. We do them because they're necessary for recovery. And if I want to get physically and mentally and spiritually and emotionally rehabilitated, I have to work this program. I've tried every other way of getting the vital spiritual experience. None of it worked. A couple of symbolic victories, but it's all transitory. And I get into those steps. Is it nice to go into the program and find out who you are and who you're not? Yeah, but my life caught on fire when I turned around and tried to help another man through the program. I might look back at my life here, as I said there, I'm sober long enough that life's lived forward but understood backwards. And I look back at my life and I see my sobriety, surrender, surrender, surrender all through my life. You know, getting... You know, and that's the thing. Every time there's been a problem in my life, if a spiritual CSI team come in, it's my fingerprints are all over it. And that's why I continue to try to surrender, to get my fingerprints off my life so that God's fingerprints are the only things on my life. And that's not easy. That's why we come to meetings. That's why we talk to a sponsor. That's why we do all the things are here, to get my fingerprints off my life. So the only fingerprints that are on it are the ones that really count, God's fingerprints. And I went through difficult times in sobriety. I thought in the last few minutes, I'll say this, I thought when I finally did the program of AA, I thought I'd walk between the raindrops and I'd get immunity from life. I thought if I'm a good boy in AA and eat my AA vegetables, you know, nothing would happen to me. And that's not reality. Life goes on, you know. But because of Alcoholics Anonymous today, my life has got meaning. My life has got purpose. Life is hard. Without meaning, life is unbearable. And if you're new, the roller coaster goes up and goes down. Just don't get off. About the hardest thing you'll ever do is getting sober. The only thing harder than getting sober is drinking yourself to death. So it's a hard thing. So the roller coaster goes up and down. Just don't get off. And I look back at my life and things happen. You've heard me tell this story, 20 years sober, went through a divorce, almost put my head away. And I had to surrender to that. And my sponsor would say to me, Paul, I want you to take the high road. I said, I'm not taking the high road. Do you know what happened to me? Another guy involved, I've been going on for years. I said, no, I'm not taking the high road. But thank God, I listened to God working through people and took actions I didn't want to take and got down on my hands and knees. And forgive people that I didn't want to forgive because I wanted to be free and Alcoholics Anonymous. You know, I believe those spiritual laws are as fixed as the physical laws in the universe. I would never try to cheat the physical law of gravity, but I try to cheat the spiritual law of forgiveness. I will forgive him, but not her. I will forgive you, but just this much. And I seen it that time in 20 years sober. I don't know if I was going to drink, but my life was completely unmanageable. I give this guy, I didn't know who he was, I give him my appetite. I give him my sleep. I give him my serenity. I give him my peace of mind. The only thing I didn't give him was my sobriety. And my sponsor says, Paul, you got to get down on your hands and knees, my friend, and you got to let it go. You got to forgive. You got to take the high road. And I was in so much pain at 20 years sober. I got down on my hands and knees and I took that situation that I was trying to manage, putting square blocks in round holes. And I just almost physically, I just took it in my two hands. I could cry telling you the story. And I said, God, here, I can't do this anymore. I'm at the jumping off place again at 20 years sober. And I just handed it over. I didn't find that cathartic, whatever, but I started to sleep a little bit better. I started to eat a little bit better. I wasn't obsessed as much. And slowly, I started to turn around. I walked into that forest and slowly turned around and started to walk back out into the daylight. I live in the same neighborhood as my ex-wife. And she married that guy and I'm happy for them. And I got remarried myself. I see them all the time. I drive by. If you were to take my blood pressure when he drives past me, I don't even think my blood pressure would go up. Because I'm free today, because I surrendered, I handed it over to God, you know. So this whole program, it's ongoing surrender. And it's funny how things happen. I'll end in this story. Just the other morning, it's funny how God works. Now, I said that I have a two-year-old daughter from marriage with Catherine, and I have a 16-year-old daughter from my first marriage, with which I was just talking about, that broke up, and my wife got remarried. And we live in the same neighborhood. So some nights my 16-year-old stays with me, and some nights she stays with her mom. But just the other day there, I went to get my wife coffee at 6:30. I don't know, like 6 o'clock in the morning, and it's pitch 6:30, and it was pitch black. And I'm coming out of the coffee shop, and I hear this voice saying, "Daddy, Daddy!" And it was my daughter. She was going to school, and her mother was driving her, and they were at the another coffee shop just up the street, Dunkin' Donuts. And she comes running down the street. Now, here's this little girl. When she was 9 years of age, I'd be putting her to bed when that divorce was happening. And she'd be crying, saying, "Daddy, I don't want to get divorced." And I'd be going into the living room after putting her to bed, saying, "Oh, my God, what have I done? My life's completely." And she comes running down the street. And this is 6:30 in the morning. She throws her arms around me. "Daddy!" Because, you know, didn't expect to see me on the block at that time. Give me a big hug. And I'm like, "What are you doing?" She goes, "Oh, Mom and I are getting coffee. She's going to drive me to school today." And she gave me a big hug. And I'm like, "Oh, it's so good to see you and whatnot. And whatever. And you know, and she went back into the, and she ran into the coffee shop, and I'm pulling up the street in my car, and my wife's sitting, I said, the coffee shop, and I put my window down. And here's a woman I said I'd never look at. I'd never talk to again. And I put the window down, and I said, hey. And she, oh, how you doing? I said, oh, it's expensive driving her to school. She wants coffee and wants a donut and one. And she laughed. And I said, oh, yeah, she's expensive, all right. And I said, I'll see you later. And I drove off down the street free, because I took actions years before that I didn't want to take. I took actions I didn't believe in. I surrendered to a situation I couldn't handle anymore. And I would like to tell you that I surrender, but I have to wait till the dogs are right here. And then I'm like, okay, God, you know. But I got there eventually. And just driving up the street that morning, my daughter, 16, happy as can be. My ex-wife, I wish her well. I hope she's happy. The marriage was over. She was just the first one to jump. I understand that today. I'm hoping she's happy. And just was a reminder as I drove the street, no thoughts, no anger, no resentment, free, because I'd surrendered to a situation a number of years earlier. So it's the old saying in Alcoholics Anonymous, how free do you want to be? And I want to be free today. You know, the old thing is, you know, I got a few friends that were sober a while, and they'll say to me, Paul, you're a real squeaky wheel. And I say, that's right. If you're in my life, you know what's going on. You know, the old legend of Bluebeard, you're allowed to go anywhere in the house, and there was one room you weren't allowed to go into. And you know what was in that one room? Anger, all the ills of the world. I can't have a single room that I keep to myself. If you're in my life, you know what's going on today. And I refuse. I carried so many yesterdays around. I refuse to live that way today. I want to be free today. And Alcoholics Anonymous gives me the opportunity. I said, a group of Northern Ireland during the Troubles, we sang about freedom. We marched in the streets for freedom. We would have sat in pubs talking about freedom. I wouldn't have known freedom if it jumped up next to me. Because of surrender in that first step, and surrendering constantly and trying to stay surrendered in the last three steps, I'm free today. I don't know about tomorrow, but right here, right now, I'm free today. And it's because of Alcoholics Anonymous. So I want to thank you for asking me to come down and speak to your group. It's been a privilege and an honor. And Billy, that's all I'll say. It's good to see us all again. And thank you so much.